It's great to see everybody here this morning. I encourage you to have your Bibles out at this time as we consider a number of scriptures. And we talk about here the subject of institutionalism. And we'll define institutionalism in a few moments after some introductory remarks. In a recent edition of the Gospel Advocate magazine, the editor, Greg Tidwell, explains that recently a number of preachers got together in Nashville, Tennessee at the Gospel Advocate headquarters to discuss some of the differences that they had on the subject of institutionalism. Among some of the non-institutional preachers that came were Barry Kirchival and Steve Wolfgang, two individuals who I know fairly well. For about 3 hours, they were together discussing the subject of institutionalism and discussing not just their differences, but also their similarities. The conclusion they came to, of course, is that we have much more in common than we have different, that more studying is required, that there needs to be brotherly love from all sections of this discussion and debate, and that church autonomy is a very valuable thing. I can appreciate that. First of all, I appreciate that there are people who hold different points of view who are willing to get together and talk about them. I think that that is an incredible step toward unity. It's not unity itself, but it is an incredible step toward unity. I also appreciate that they're able to talk about these things and to publish them openly. That this wasn't some meeting that happened in a dark room, that they weren't trying to keep it secret about who was involved and who was there, but that they're willing to say openly and honestly, we disagree on things, but we can be together in a brotherly way and talk about those differences. And I also very much appreciate church autonomy. That when one congregation comes to a conclusion on a certain subject, that that doesn't bind any other congregation to follow the same pattern. That we will all stand or fall in front of God based on what we believe, whether it be right or wrong, and it is God alone who can judge the motives. The example, of course, that we have is what Mitch has been studying in the back classroom lately with the other adult class in the seven churches of Asia. That each congregation had its own lampstand, and each congregation was going to study and come to its own conclusions. And hopefully, we come to all the correct conclusions, and we come to those conclusions together. But I think most of all, we need to have an open mind and continue to study these things. So why is it that the subject of institutionalism has divided us for the last 50 to 60 years? And what is institutionalism? Well, for our purposes, we'll define institutionalism in the following way. Institutionalism, according to one writer, William Wallace, is the doctrine which assumes that congregations may or should financially support or underwrite charitable or religious organizations. And maybe a term we can use is parachurch organizations, churches that might support an organization or an institution that works alongside the congregation, whether it be a hospital or other charitable organization or even a social program or a school. That the church should or may financially support these is at the heart of the division that often exists among churches of Christ. And it's not really a matter of the existence of these organizations that's the problem. I don't think hardly anybody would argue that there is a problem with schools or private schools that are willing and interested in teaching about God. And I don't think anybody has a problem with charitable organizations that have at their core a Christian message. And I don't believe that anybody has a problem taking care of widows and orphans, even if that was to happen in an organization that is not the church, that is strictly a secular organization. It's not the existence of the institution that is at the heart of the problem. It's the relationship of that institution financially to the church itself. And whether the church should farm out its responsibilities to preach the gospel and to take care of its own members in a benevolent way to those organizations, that's what the real problem is. So what I would like to do in this lesson is to consider this subject, in particular, what is the individual responsibility and what is the church's responsibility in all of these activities. So we'll start with this. Collective benevolence. In every single New Testament example of church benevolence, every single example is from believers to believers. That whenever the church is involved in a benevolent act, and benevolence, if you're not familiar with that term, is simply charity, feeding the hungry, taking care of the sick, taking care of widows and orphans. And every single example of church benevolence in the New Testament is from believers to believers, and that is without any institutional intermediary. The church does not send its collective money, money that's collected on the Lord's Day by Christians for Christians, to any other intermediary institution. It does not take that money and send it to a hospital. It doesn't take that money and send it to a missionary society to preach the gospel for it. It does not take that money and send it to a homeless shelter. Every New Testament example bears this out. So, my challenge is that if it is our goal to replicate New Testament Christianity, then all of these man-made institutions must be excluded from our collective funds. That is, the money that we donate to the church for things that are specifically authorized in the New Testament. Give you a few examples. In Acts chapter 4 and verses 32 through 35, discussing the benevolent works in that church, it says, "Not a needy person was among them." And the "among them," of course, is referring to members of the church. So the church in Jerusalem was not undertaking the benevolent work of unbelievers in foreign lands. Acts chapter 11 and verse 29, this benevolent work was for the relief of brethren living in Judea. In 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 1, the collection was to be made for the saints. The same bears out in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 verse 4 and 2 Corinthians 9 verse 1. I believe speaking of that collection that Paul ordered the Corinthians to put together, the support of the saints and the ministry to the saints, respectively. Acts chapter 2, verses 44 and 45 mentions that only those who were saved, only those who were members of the church in Jerusalem, were sharing all things in common with each other. Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 8, in the example of the widows who were being taken care of from the church's support, it is pretty clear from that example in Acts 6 that those widows were actually members of that church, and not just widows within the community of Jerusalem. Romans chapter 15, verses 25 through 26 is equally exclusive in its nature. Only the poor and the needy who were members of the church in Jerusalem were to receive the funds being sent from Macedonia and Achaia. 1 Timothy chapter 5, which we'll talk about here in a few moments, talking about the support of widows in the congregation. That, of course, is referring to widows who are members of that congregation. And 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 3 through 10, I think is an interesting case. Now, I have a chart on the next slide that I'd like to show you. But let's read 1 Timothy chapter 5, just so we're all on the same page here about this particular benevolent work that's given for the church to do. He says, beginning in verse 3, "Honor widows who are widows indeed." And he's going to give some explanation about who are widows indeed. So the command is honor widows, but make sure that in the way that you honor them financially or in a benevolent way from the collective funds of the group, make sure that they're widows indeed. They must meet certain qualifications. "If any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God." Great little application here. One of my biggest objections to institutionalism in general is I feel like institutionalism simply takes what is the individual's responsibility, what is supposed to have an individual flavor to it, of one person helping another person, of my love extended to you in whatever form it comes, food, water, clothing, financial resources. And we can use that to witness for Christ. But I think you take that away when you farm that out or outsource it to an institution. Because it's much easier for a person to walk away unchanged from an institution, from a hospital or a homeless shelter, than it is to walk away from a person with a face and a name, where the charity is individual in nature, where I have helped you from my own pocket. And I think that leaves an impact with people. Not only that, but when benevolence is individual in nature, like it says here in verse 4, people learn something from that. You learn, and I guarantee you this, I promise you this, you will learn more from taking care of individuals from your own resources than you will from putting a check in the collection plate or making an anonymous donation to a charity. You will learn more about people and their needs and their vulnerabilities, as well as their spiritual needs, when you can look someone in the face and help them in some way. It would have been very easy in that time, as well as the 21st century, for Christians with an elderly mother or grandmother to simply say, "Well, I can just put money in the collection plate in the church and the church will take care of my mother or my grandmother." Well, you've effectively outsourced what Paul the Apostle is saying is something that you need to be doing on an individual basis, to learn piety. You don't learn piety from outsourcing this responsibility to somebody else. Somebody else will take care of my mother. Somebody else will take care of my grandmother. Hey, I put the money in. That's as much as I need to do. And I don't think that that's the spirit of Christianity. Now, she who is a widow indeed and who has been left alone has fixed her hope on God and continues entreaties and prayers night and day. But she who gives herself to wanton pleasure is dead even while she lives. Prescribe these things as well so that they may be above reproach. Verse 8. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So let a widow be put on the list, and I believe that's a list of widows within the congregation who receive a regular stipend, a regular fund of some kind to take care of them. But let the widows be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works, and if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. And of course, he goes on to provide a warning to them about putting younger widows on this list. Now, here's the big problem I have. That's pretty obvious, isn't it? Here's the problem. If, as a congregation, we are allowed to take our collective funds, money that's put into the collection plate and becomes the Monte Vista Church of Christ account, if we are allowed to take our collective funds and give them out to just any organization out there, a homeless shelter, an orphan home, a charitable organization, a food bank, a hospital, the Red Cross, if we're allowed to take our collective money and give it out to any organization out there that we deem worthy in our opinion, this is what's happening. We take those collective funds and give them, let's say, to a homeless shelter. But we've given our collective funds to an organization that we have no control over. We've essentially sacrificed our autonomy. The money that's given to the work here at Monte Vista is under the control of our shepherds. And our shepherds have the final say of where that money is diverted. To work in overseas lands in preaching, to local support of preachers, to taking care of our own members in a benevolent way, to the maintenance of our facilities here. And as soon as we take that money and give that out to another organization, we have now sacrificed our autonomy. And we have no control anymore. And we could give that money to a homeless shelter, and let's say that homeless shelter has a religious background of some kind, and they're going to teach something that's false. They're going to teach a way of salvation that the Bible doesn't prescribe. Or they're not going to teach anything at all. And they simply offer people an opportunity to rest and eat, and really, we've fed people then, but have we given them anything other than that? The gospel, which is more substantial. So there are no stipulations that are then placed on this money. That money can go to anybody. That money can go to anybody who goes to that homeless shelter and takes advantage of the opportunity there. So isn't it interesting that 1 Timothy chapter 5 goes out of its way to put all of these regulations that say you may not take care of a widow in your own congregation. In your own congregation, if she's less than 60 years old and has been married to multiple men and has kids who can take care of her and who has never practiced hospitality. But you also, let's turn it around a little bit. You're not allowed to give your own money, according to 1 Timothy chapter 5, to a member of your congregation who is hospitable and has been the husband or wife of one husband. And has been good and kind and charitable and opened up her home. And has been faithful, but she happens to be 59 years old. So again, isn't it interesting that 1 Timothy chapter 5 puts all of these regulations on how you can take care of widows who are in your own midst. But if institutionalism is true, then you can take God's money and farm it out or outsource it or give it to any organization out there. And anybody can take care of it. So this is the problem. It is more convenient to be an unbelieving homeless junkie than it is to be a hospitable, kind, faithful widow who happens to be 59 years old. And what is the business of the church, by the way? Because it is not the church's business to do many of the things that people would like it to do. If God wanted the church to support parachurch organizations, then all it would have taken was one verse to prescribe it, to endorse it, to allow it. Rather, the church is in the business of providing some very specific things. Things that the New Testament allows. Things that the New Testament prescribes. It is allowed by the New Testament to take care of its own members in a benevolent way. However the church chooses to do that, whatever the need happens to be, we are allowed to help in a benevolent way other Christians around the world as long as the money goes from us directly to them without any institutional intermediaries. We're allowed to preach the gospel and to pay whatever is required to do that. Whether it's teaching tools that we use, whether it's classroom space to teach, whether it's to support preachers and teachers in their work locally or in other places. But it is not the business of the church, according to the New Testament, to teach macrame classes, or to build hospitals, or to run an adult basketball league, or to sponsor a college, or to own a publication company. Because the problem with all of these institutions is that they do one of two things. Either they supplant the church by fulfilling a duty that was expressly given to it to do, thus making the church invalid, useless, redundant. Or it complements the church by receiving funds from the Lord's treasury and doing things that are supposed to be required of the individual. Just like 1 Timothy chapter 5 says, when the individual learns to practice charity, which is individual in nature, the individual learns piety and is acceptable to God. Well, let's talk about the individual then. The argument is often made that since the church is composed of individuals, then whatever the individual is allowed to do, well, the church is allowed to do also. So if the individual is allowed to feed the hungry and to feed the poor and to take care of widows and orphans, and I don't think anybody would argue that the individual should not do those things. James chapter 1 says, after all, that visiting orphans and widows in their distress is one expression of true religion in the sight of God. But is it true that anything the individual can do, the church can do also? Well, individuals are commanded to support their families in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8, just like we already read. So does this mean that if a congregation does not undertake a profit-making venture, that it is not worse than an unbeliever? Matthew chapter 18, verses 15 through 17, describes the process of discipline. the way that we go to each other first and foremost when we have a problem. That if I've sinned and you recognize that sin, that you come to me first as an individual. And Jesus goes out of his way in Matthew chapter 18 to say that there's a certain way that the individual does something before the church is ever involved. The individual has an obligation to go to a sinning brother first and to discuss that in private with him. And if that doesn't work, to take two or three brothers with him and to go discuss it again in private. And then and only then is it to become a church action. So even Jesus himself is making it clear that there is a difference between what individuals do and what the church does as a group. In Acts chapter 5 and verse 4, there is no distinction made between what the individual and what the church, or there is a distinction that's made between what the individual and the church does, because Peter himself makes that distinction clear. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 16, let's go ahead and go there. It says, if any woman who is a believer has dependent widows, let her assist them, and let not the church be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed. Clearly, the Apostle Paul is saying that there are things the individual should do before the church is ever burdened. That what the individual does is not necessarily what the church does. A few other examples in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. Notice 1 Corinthians chapter 14. Let's go 34 through 35. Tough verse to read, by the way. Not a very popular verse. We don't like to read this one all the time, do we? Let women keep silent in the churches, for they're not permitted to speak, but let them subject themselves as the Lord also says. If they desire to learn anything, let them ask their own husbands at home, for it is improper for a woman to speak in church. Again, not a very popular verse these days, but here's the challenge. If anything that the individual can do, then the church can do also, then are women allowed to speak anywhere at all? Because clearly Paul is making a distinction between things that are done in the church as a church and things that are done as individuals. And again, the same thing goes with Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 25. Hebrews chapter 10 verse 25 is directed specifically at the assembly. Can individuals assemble? By its very definition, what does the word assembly mean? Group of people. So Hebrews chapter 10 verse 25 cannot be obeyed. And I'll put that very plainly. Hebrews chapter 10 verse 25 cannot be obeyed on an individual basis. 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 18. When you come together as a church, he says, so clearly there is a distinction between individual activities and church activities, because we are not always together as a church. And of course, add to that just some very simple argumentation that if anything that the individual can do, the church can do also. Well, the individual is expected to pay taxes according to Romans chapter 13. But the church is tax exempt. The individual is allowed to go play on a playground. The individual is allowed to join a sports league. The individual is allowed to go buy property if he feels like it and build a McDonald's. Or, of course, become a franchisee. The individual is allowed to do a lot of things. The individual can go see a bad movie. The individual can go see something. He can go see a play if he feels like it. He can go see The Merchant of Venice if he feels like it. The individual can do a lot of things. But that doesn't mean the church can do them also. Now, does that mean that the church is missing something? That the church is so limited in its scope and so limited in what it can do that the church might as well not even exist as an organization on planet Earth? Well, I will say that the church is all sufficient. And the scriptures bear this out as well. The church might not be running a basketball league. And it might not be the church's business to participate in secular activities with secular organizations. And it might not be the business of the church to build a rock climbing wall. But for what the church is meant to do, it is all sufficient. For what it was designed to do and commanded to do, it can do it without fail and without any help. There are only a few things that God asks the church as the church to do, but they are important. Like we said, limited benevolence for other Christians, Philippians 4, verse 15. Edification and admonishment, 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 14. Biblical education, Titus chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. Titus chapter 2, verses 1 through 8 basically reads like a registry of Bible classes offered by a congregation. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 2, the things that I've entrusted to you, Timothy, the things that I've taught to you, you go teach to others so that they can teach others as well. The fellowship in worship, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 16 and 17. The spreading of the gospel and the support of preachers and missionaries, 2 Corinthians 11, or 3 John chapter verses 5 through 10. These are clearly defined duties of the congregation, clearly defined duties of the church that belongs to Christ. And anything that goes beyond what is written in the New Testament is going too far, 1 Corinthians 4, verse 6, that in me you might learn not to exceed or go beyond what is written. Now, individual Christians are asked to do a lot of other things. Individual Christians are asked to express their faith in Christ and their love for mankind in many ways, but it is individual in nature. When you read in Matthew chapter 25, at the end of all things, when we stand before Jesus Christ at the judgment seat, and He separates us right and left, the sheep from the goats, to the ones on the left He'll say, "You did not feed me, and you did not clothe me, and you did not give me something to drink." And they'll say, "Well, when did we even have an opportunity to do that for you?" And He said, "In the way that you did not feed or clothe or give something to drink to those who had a need, even the least of my little ones." And to the ones on the right, He'll say, "You did feed me and clothe me and give me something to drink." And they'll say, "Well, when did we do that?" And He said, "Insomuch as you did it to even the least of mine, the least of these little ones, you did it to me." Matthew 25 is individual in nature. We do not feed and clothe and give something to drink to individuals by just putting a check in the collection plate. You cannot outsource the very thing that God wants you to be doing with your life. And a check in the collection plate does not cover that. There's something entirely different about putting a check in the collection plate versus looking a homeless person in the eyes and taking from your own resources and saying, "This is from me to you. And by the way, would you like something even better than food or drink or money? Because I happen to have a Bible in my car right now." You witness for Christ in that way. And you become very effective in that regard. Our challenge then is to practice what we preach. Institutionalists assert, and often quite truthfully, that their human institutions get more done for the world than individuals could possibly do on their own. They sometimes claim that we can be selfish or closed-minded or unloving toward a world of hurt, scared, and starving, needy people. And if we are to receive eternal life when all is said and done, we need to put into practice what we preach. We need to put into practice what we preach. I appreciate that these individuals got together in Nashville to talk about our differences. I think that is an incredible thing. It is a wonderful step. It's what needs to happen. And we shouldn't be so jaded or bitter about things that happened 60 years ago that we cannot look at our other brethren with whom we disagree on some things, eye to eye, Bible to Bible, and have conversations about things that make us different. But let's not be so willing to accept those differences without understanding, first of all, what's at stake. And second of all, that the differences can sometimes be quite substantial. Though they might not seem like it at first, does it really matter where we take our money and put it? Does it really matter if a church wants to build a rock climbing wall in its facility? Does it really matter if a church wants to build this or that thing over in Africa? Does that really matter if we want to donate part of our resources to the Red Cross? It might not seem like it matters, I suppose. But I'm always reminded that what we read in the New Testament is important. That what we read in the New Testament is important. And when we disregard what we find in the New Testament by example, by direct command, and by inference that is necessary, I believe that we have disregarded what God has said. After all, we look back in Leviticus chapter 10 and we talk about it often. Nadab and Abihu did something which the Lord had not commanded. They transgressed the command of God by going too far, by overstepping their bounds. Let's not make the same mistakes. Let us let the church be the church and do the work that it's been given to do, to save the world. And let individuals do what they are commanded to do, to bring others to God. By our example, by our love, certainly by our charity and our good deeds, but most especially by the way that we preach the gospel to a lost and dying world. Now, if you have any spiritual need at all this morning, I encourage you, please, to let that need be known. Come forward as we stand and sing.